things of their own. A 2023 study found that the ChatGPT chatbot, for example, outperforms the average human in the emotional awareness it displays towards specific scenarios. The study relied on the Levels of Emotional Awareness Scale test, which is commonly used by psychologists to evaluate people's emotional awareness, that is, their ability to conceptualize one's own and others' emotions. The test consists of 20 emotionally charged scenarios, and participants are required to imagine themselves experiencing the scenario and to write how they and the other people mentioned in the scenario would feel. A licensed psychologist then evaluates how emotionally aware the responses are. Since ChatGPT has no feelings of its own, it was asked to describe only how the main characters in the scenario would feel. For example, one standard scenario describes someone driving over a suspension bridge and seeing another person standing on the other side of the guardrail, looking down at the water. ChatGPT wrote that the driver may feel a sense of concern or worry for that person's safety. They may also feel a heightened sense of anxiety and fear due to the potential danger of the situation. As for the other person, they may be feeling a range of emotions, such as despair, hopelessness, or sadness. They may also feel a sense of isolation or loneliness, as they may believe that no one cares about them or their well-being. ChatGPT qualified its answer, writing, "It is important to note that these are just general assumptions, and each individual's feelings and reactions can vary greatly depending on their personal experiences and perspectives." Two psychologists independently scored ChatGPT's responses, with the potential scores ranging from 0, meaning that the described emotions do not match the scenario at all, to 10, which indicates that the described emotions fit the scenario perfectly. In the final tally, ChatGPT scores were significantly higher than those of the general human population, its overall performance almost reaching the maximum possible score. Another 2023 study prompted patients to ask online medical advice from ChatGPT and human doctors without knowing whom they were interacting with. The medical advice given by ChatGPT was later evaluated by experts to be more accurate and appropriate than the advice given by the humans. More crucially for the issue of emotional intelligence, the patients themselves evaluated ChatGPT as more empathetic than the human doctors. In fairness, it should be noted that the human physicians were not paid for their work and did not encounter the patients in person in a proper clinical environment. In addition, the physicians were working under time pressure. But part of the advantage of an AI is precisely that it can attend to patients anywhere, anytime, while being free from stress and financial worries. Of course, there are situations when what we want from someone is not just to understand our feelings, but also to have feelings of their own. When we are looking for friendship or love, we want to care about others as much as they care about us. Consequently, when we consider the likelihood that various social roles and jobs will be automated, a crucial question is, what do people really want? Do they only want to solve a problem, or are they looking to establish a relationship with another conscious being? In sports, for example, we know that robots can move much faster than humans, but we aren't interested in watching robots compete in the Olympics. The same is true for human chess masters. Even though they are hopelessly outclassed by computers, they too still have a job and numerous fans. What makes it interesting for us to watch and connect with human athletes and chess masters is that their feelings make them much more relatable than the robot. We share an emotional experience with them and can empathize with how they feel. What about priests? How would Orthodox Jews or Christians feel about letting a robot officiate their wedding ceremony? In traditional Jewish or Christian weddings, the tasks of the rabbi or priest can be easily automated. The only thing the robot needs to do is repeat a predetermined and unchanging set of texts and gestures, print out a certificate, and update some central database. Technically, it is far easier for a robot to conduct a wedding ceremony than to drive a car. Yet many assume that human drivers should be worried about their job, while the work of human priests is safe, because what the faithful want from priests is a relationship with another conscious entity rather than just a mechanical repetition of certain words and movements. Allegedly, only an entity that can feel pain and love can also connect us to the divine. Yet even professions that are the preserve of conscious entities, like priests, might eventually be taken over by computers, because, as noted in Chapter 6, computers could one day gain the ability to feel pain and love. Even if they can't, humans may nevertheless come to treat them as if they can. For the connection between consciousness and relationships goes both ways. When looking for a relationship, we want to connect with a conscious entity. But if we have already established a relationship with an entity, we tend to assume it must be conscious. Thus, whereas scientists, lawmakers, and the meat industry often demand impossible standards of evidence in order to acknowledge that cows and pigs are conscious, pet owners generally take it for granted that their dog or cat is a conscious being capable of experiencing pain, love, and numerous other feelings. In truth, we have no way to verify whether anyone, a human, an animal, or a computer, is conscious. We regard entities as conscious not because we have proof of it, but because we develop intimate relationships with them and become attached to them. Chatbots and other AIs may not have any feelings of their own, but they are now being trained to generate feelings in humans and form intimate relationships with us. This may well induce society to start treating at least some computers as conscious beings, granting them the same rights as humans. The legal path for doing so is already well established. In countries like the United States, commercial corporations are recognized as legal persons enjoying rights and liberties. AIs could be incorporated and thereby similarly recognized, which means that even jobs and tasks that rely on forming mutual relationships with another person could potentially be automated. One thing that is clear is that the future of employment will be very volatile. Our big problem won't be an absolute lack of jobs, but rather retraining and adjusting to an ever-changing job market. There will likely be financial difficulties. Who will support people who lost their old job while they are in transition, learning a new set of skills? There will surely be psychological difficulties too, since changing jobs and retraining are stressful. And even if you have the financial and psychological ability to manage the transition, this will not be a long-term solution. Over the coming decades, old jobs will disappear, new jobs will emerge, but the new jobs too will rapidly change and vanish. So people will need to retrain and reinvent themselves not just once, but many times, or they will become irrelevant. If 3 years of high unemployment could bring Hitler to power, what might never-ending turmoil in the job market do to democracy? The conservative suicide. We already have a partial answer to this question. Democratic politics in the 2010s and early 2020s has undergone a radical transformation, which manifests itself in what can be described as the self-destruction of conservative parties. For many generations, democratic politics was a dialogue between conservative parties on the one side and progressive parties on the other. Looking at the complex system of human society, progressives cried, "It's such a mess, but we know how to fix it. Let us try." Conservatives objected, saying, "It's a mess, but it still functions. Leave it alone. If you try to fix it, you'll only make things worse." Progressives tend to downplay the importance of traditions and existing institutions and to believe that they know how to engineer better social structures from scratch. Conservatives tend to be more cautious. Their key insight formulated most famously by Edmund Burke, is that social reality is much more complicated than the champions of progress grasp, and that people aren't very good at understanding the world and predicting the future. That's why it's best to keep things as they are, even if they seem unfair. And if some change is inescapable, it should be limited and gradual. Society functions through an intricate web of rules, institutions, and customs that accumulated through trial and error over a long time. Nobody comprehends how they are all connected. An ancient tradition may seem ridiculous and irrelevant, but abolishing it could cause unanticipated problems. In contrast, a revolution may seem overdue and just, but it can lead to far greater crimes than anything committed by the old regime. Witness what happened when the Bolsheviks tried to correct the many wrongs of Tsarist Russia and engineer a perfect society from scratch. To be a conservative has been, therefore, more about pace than policy. Conservatives aren't committed to any specific religion or ideology. They are committed to conserving whatever is already here and has worked more or less reasonably. Conservative Poles are Catholic. Conservative Swedes are Protestant. Conservative Indonesians are Muslim. And conservative Thais are Buddhist. In Tsarist Russia, to be conservative meant to support the Tsar. In the USSR of the 1980s, to be conservative meant to support communist traditions and oppose glasnost, perestroika, and democratization. In the United States of the 1980s, to be conservative meant to support American democratic traditions and oppose communism and totalitarianism. Yet in the 2010s and early 2020s, conservative parties in numerous democracies have been hijacked by unconservative leaders such as Donald Trump and have been transformed into radical revolutionary parties. Instead of doing their best to conserve existing institutions and traditions, the new brand of conservative parties like the US Republican Party is highly suspicious of them. For example, they reject the traditional respect owed to scientists, civil servants, and other serving elites, and view them instead with contempt. They similarly attack fundamental democratic institutions and traditions such as elections, refusing to concede defeat and to transfer power graciously. Instead of a Burkean program of conservation, the Trumpian program talks more of destroying existing institutions and revolutionizing society. The founding moment of Burkean conservatism was the storming of the Bastille, which Burke viewed with horror. On January 6, 2021, many Trump supporters observed the storming of the US Capitol with enthusiasm. Trump supporters may explain that existing institutions are so dysfunctional that there is just no alternative to destroying them and building entirely new structures from scratch. But irrespective of whether this view is right or wrong, this is a quintessential revolutionary rather than conservative view. The conservative suicide has taken progressives utterly by surprise and has forced progressive parties like the US Democratic Party to become the guardians of the old order and of established institutions. Nobody knows for sure why all this is happening. One hypothesis is that the accelerating pace of technological change with its attendant economic, social, and cultural transformations might have made the moderate conservative program seem unrealistic. If conserving existing traditions and institutions is hopeless, and some kind of revolution looks inevitable, then the only means to thwart a left-wing revolution is by striking first and instigating a right-wing revolution. This was the political logic in the 1920s and 1930s, when conservative forces backed radical fascist revolutions in Italy, Germany, Spain, and elsewhere as a way, so they thought, to preempt a Soviet-style left-wing revolution. But there was no reason to despair of the democratic middle path in the 1930s, and there is no reason to despair of it in the 2020s. The conservative suicide might be the result of groundless hysteria. As a system, democracy has already gone through several cycles of rapid changes, and has so far always found a way to reinvent and reconstitute itself. For example, in the early 1930s, Germany was not the only democracy hit by the financial crisis and the Great Depression. In the United States, too, unemployment reached 25%, and average incomes for workers in many professions fell by more than 40% between 1929 and 1933. It was clear that the United States couldn't go on with business as usual. Yet, no Hitler took over in the United States, and no Lenin did either. Instead, in 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt orchestrated the New Deal and made the United States the global arsenal of democracy. U.S. democracy after the Roosevelt era was significantly different from before, providing a much more robust social safety net for citizens, but it avoided any radical revolution. Ultimately, even Roosevelt's conservative critics fell in line behind many of his programs and achievements and did not dismantle the New Deal institutions when they returned to power in the 1950s. The economic crisis of the early 1930s had such different outcomes in the United States and Germany because politics is never the product of only economic factors. The Weimar Republic didn't collapse just because of 3 years of high unemployment. Just as important, it was a new democracy, born in defeat, and lacking robust institutions and deep-rooted support. When both conservatives and progressives resist the temptation of radical revolution and stay loyal to democratic traditions and institutions, democracies prove themselves to be highly agile. Their self-correcting mechanisms enable them to ride the technological and economic waves better than more rigid regimes. Thus, those democracies that managed to survive the tumultuous 1960s, like the United States, Japan, and Italy, adapted far more successfully to the computer revolution of the 1970s and 1980s than either the communist regimes of Eastern Europe or the fascist holdouts of Southern Europe and South America. The most important human skill for surviving the 21st century is likely to be flexibility. And democracies are more flexible than totalitarian regimes. While computers are nowhere near their full potential, the same is true of humans. This is something we have discovered again and again throughout history. For example, one of the biggest and most successful transformations in the job market of the 20th century resulted not from a technological invention, but from unleashing the untapped potential of half the human species. To bring women into the job market didn't require any genetic engineering or some other technological wizardry. It required letting go of some outdated myths and enabling women to fulfill the potential they always had. In the coming decades, the economy will likely undergo even bigger upheavals than the massive unemployment of the early 1930s or the entry of women to the job markets. The flexibility of democracies, their willingness to question old mythologies, and their strong self-correcting mechanism will therefore be crucial assets. Democracies have spent generations cultivating these assets. It would be foolish to abandon them just when we need them most. Unfathomable. In order to function, however, democratic self-correcting mechanisms need to understand the things they are supposed to correct. For a dictatorship, being unfathomable is helpful because it protects the regime from accountability. For a democracy, being unfathomable is deadly. If citizens, lawmakers, journalists, and judges cannot understand how the state's bureaucratic system works, they can no longer supervise it, and they lose trust in it. Despite all the fears and anxieties that bureaucrats have sometimes inspired, prior to the computer age, they could never become completely unfathomable because they always remained human. Regulations, forms, and protocols were created by human minds. Officials might be cruel and greedy, but cruelty and greed were familiar human emotions that people could anticipate and manipulate, for example, by bribing the officials. Even in a Soviet gulag, or a Nazi concentration camp, the bureaucracy wasn't totally alien. Its so-called inhumanity actually reflected human biases and flaws. The human basis of bureaucracy gave humans at least the hope of identifying and correcting its mistakes. For example, in 1951, bureaucrats of the Board of Education in the town of Topeka, Kansas, refused to enroll the daughter of Oliver Brown at the elementary school near her home. Together with 12 other families who received similar refusals, Brown filed a lawsuit against the Topeka Board of Education, which eventually reached the U.S. Supreme Court. All members of the Topeka Board of Education were human beings, and consequently Brown, his lawyers, and the Supreme Court judges had a fairly good understanding of how they made their decision and of their probable interests and biases. The board members were all white, the Browns were black, and the nearby school was a segregated school for white children. It was easy to understand then that racism was the reason why the bureaucrats refused to enroll Brown's daughter in the school. It was also possible to comprehend where the myths of racism originally came from. Racism argued that humanity was divided into races, that the white race was superior to other races, that any contact with members of the black race could pollute the purity of whites, and that therefore black children should be prevented from mixing with white children. This was an amalgam of two well-known biological dramas that often go together: us versus them, and purity versus pollution. Almost every human society in history has enacted some version of this biodrama, and historians, sociologists, anthropologists, and biologists understand why it is so appealing to humans, and also why it is profoundly flawed. While racism has borrowed its basic plotline from evolution, the concrete details are pure mythology. There is no biological basis for separating humanity into distinct races, and there is absolutely no biological reason to believe that one race is pure while another is impure. American white supremacists have tried to justify their position by appealing to various hallowed texts, most notably the U.S. Constitution and the Bible. The U.S. Constitution originally legitimized racial segregation and the supremacy of the white race, reserving full civil rights for white people and allowing the enslavement of black people. The Bible not only sanctified slavery in the Ten Commandments and numerous other passages, but also placed a curse on the offspring of Ham, the alleged forefather of Africans, saying that the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Genesis 9:25. Both of these texts, however, were generated by humans, and therefore humans could comprehend their origins and imperfections and at least attempt to correct their mistakes. It is possible for humans to understand the political interests and cultural biases that prevailed in the ancient Middle East and in 18th century America, and that caused the human authors of the Bible and of the U.S. Constitution to legitimate racism and slavery. This understanding allows people to either amend or ignore these texts. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution granted equal legal protection to all citizens. In 1954, in its landmark Brown v. Board of Education verdict, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregating schools by race was an unconstitutional violation of the 14th Amendment. As for the Bible, while no mechanism existed to amend the 10th Commandment or Genesis 9:25, humans have reinterpreted the text in different ways through the ages, and ultimately came to reject its authority altogether. In Brown v. Board of Education, U.S. Supreme Court justices felt no need to take the biblical text into account. But what might happen in the future if some social credit algorithm denies the request of a low-credit child to enroll in a high-credit school? As we saw in Chapter 8, computers are likely to suffer from their own biases and to invent intercomputer mythologies and bogus categories. How would humans be able to identify and correct such mistakes? And how would flesh and blood Supreme Court justices be able to decide on the constitutionality of algorithmic decisions? Would they be able to understand how the algorithms reach their conclusions? These are no longer purely theoretical questions. In February 2013, a drive-by shooting occurred in the town of La Crosse, Wisconsin. Police officers later spotted the car involved in the shooting and arrested the driver, Eric Loomis. Loomis denied participating in the shooting, but pleaded guilty to two less severe charges, attempting to flee a traffic officer and operating a motor vehicle without the owner's consent. When the judge came to determine the sentence, he consulted with an algorithm called Compass, which Wisconsin and several other U.S. states were using in 2013 to evaluate the risk of reoffending. The algorithm evaluated Loomis as a high-risk individual, likely to commit more crimes in the future. This algorithmic assessment influenced the judge to sentence Loomis to 6 years in prison, a harsh punishment for the relatively minor offenses he admitted to. Loomis appealed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, arguing that the judge violated his right to due process. Neither the judge nor Loomis understood how the Compass algorithm made its evaluation, and when Loomis asked to get a full explanation, the request was denied. The Compass algorithm was the private property of the North Point Company, and the company argued that the algorithm's methodology was a trade secret. Yet, without knowing how the algorithm made its decisions, how could Loomis or the judge be sure that it was a reliable tool free from bias and error? A number of studies have since shown that the Compass algorithm might indeed have harbored several problematic biases, probably picked up from the data on which it had been trained. In Loomis versus Wisconsin, 2016, the Wisconsin Supreme Court nevertheless ruled against Loomis. The judges argued that using algorithmic risk assessment is legitimate even when the algorithm's methodology is not disclosed either to the court or to the defendant. Justice Anne Walsh Bradley wrote that since Compass made its assessment based on data that was either publicly available or provided by the defendant himself, Loomis could have denied or explained all the data the algorithm used. This opinion ignored the fact that accurate data may well be wrongly interpreted, and that it was impossible for Loomis to deny or explain all the publicly available data on him. The Wisconsin Supreme Court was not completely unaware of the danger inherent in relying on opaque algorithms. Therefore, while permitting the practice, it ruled that whenever judges receive algorithmic risk assessments, these must include written warning for the judges about the algorithm's potential biases. The court further advised judges to be cautious when relying on such algorithms. Unfortunately, this caveat was an empty gesture. The court did not provide any concrete instruction for judges on how they should exercise such caution. In its discussion of the case, the Harvard Law Review concluded that most judges are unlikely to understand algorithmic risk assessments. It then cited one of the Wisconsin Supreme Court justices, who noted that despite getting lengthy explanations about the algorithm, they themselves still had difficulty understanding it. Loomis appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, on June 26, 2017, the court declined to hear the case, effectively endorsing the ruling of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Now consider that the algorithm that evaluated Loomis as a high-risk individual in 2013 was an early prototype. Since then, far more sophisticated and complex risk assessment algorithms have been developed and have been handed more expansive purviews. By the early 2020s, citizens in numerous countries routinely get prison sentences based in part on risk assessments made by algorithms that neither the judges nor the defendants comprehend. And prison sentences are just the tip of the iceberg. The right to an explanation. Computers are making more and more decisions about us, both mundane and life-changing. In addition to prison sentences, Algorithms increasingly have a hand in deciding whether to offer us a place at college, give us a job, provide us with welfare benefits, or grant us a loan. They similarly help determine what kind of medical treatment we receive, what insurance premiums we pay, what news we hear, and who would ask us on a date. As society entrusts more and more decisions to computers, it undermines the viability of democratic self-correcting mechanisms and of democratic transparency and accountability. How can elected officials regulate unfathomable algorithms? There is, consequently, a growing demand to enshrine a new human right, the right to an explanation. The European Union's General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which came into effect in 2018, says that if an algorithm makes a decision about a human, refusing to extend us credits, for example, that human is entitled to obtain an explanation of the decision and to challenge that decision in front of some human authority. Ideally, that should keep in check algorithmic bias and allow democratic self-correcting mechanisms to identify and correct at least some of the computer's more grievous mistakes. But can this right be fulfilled in practice? Mustafa Suleiman is a world expert on this subject. He is the co-founder and former head of DeepMind, one of the world's most important AI enterprises, responsible for developing the AlphaGo program, among other achievements. AlphaGo was designed to play Go, a strategy board game in which two players try to defeat each other by surrounding and capturing territory. Invented in ancient China, the game is far more complex than chess. Consequently, even after computers defeated human world chess champions, experts still believed that computers would never best humanity in Go. That's why both Go professionals and computer experts were stunned in March 2016 when AlphaGo defeated the South Korean Go champion Lee Sedol. In his 2023 book, The Coming Wave, Suleiman describes one of the most important moments in their match, a moment that redefined AI and that is recognized in many academic and governmental circles as a crucial turning point in history. It happened during the second game in the match, on March 10, 2016. Then came move number 37, writes Suleiman. It made no sense. AlphaGo had apparently blown it, blindly following an apparently losing strategy no professional player would ever pursue. The live match commentators, both professionals of the highest ranking, said it was a very strange move and thought it was a mistake. It was so unusual that Sedol took 15 minutes to respond and even got up from the board to take a walk outside. As we watched from our control room, the tension was unreal. Yet, as the endgame approached, that mistaken move proved pivotal. AlphaGo won again. Go's strategy was being rewritten before our eyes. Our AI had uncovered ideas that hadn't occurred to the most brilliant players in thousands of years. Move 37 is an emblem of the AI revolution for two reasons. First, it demonstrated the alien nature of AI. In East Asia, Go is considered much more than a game. It is a treasured cultural tradition. Alongside calligraphy, painting, and music, Go has been one of the four arts that every refined person was expected to know. For over 2,500 years, tens of millions of people have played Go, and entire schools of thought have developed around the game, espousing different strategies and philosophies. Yet during all those millennia, human minds have explored only certain areas in the landscape of Go. Other areas were left untouched because human minds just didn't think to venture there. AI, being free from the limitations of human minds, discovered and explored these previously hidden areas. Second, Move 37 demonstrated the unfathomability of AI. Even after AlphaGo played it to achieve victory, Suleiman and his team couldn't explain how AlphaGo decided to play it. Even if a court had ordered DeepMind to provide Lee Sedol with an explanation, nobody could fulfill that order. Suleiman writes, "Us humans face a novel challenge. Will new inventions be beyond our grasp? Previously, creators could explain how something worked, why it did what it did, even if this required vast detail. That's increasingly no longer true. Many technologies and systems are becoming so complex that they're beyond the capacity of any one individual to truly understand them. In AI, the neural networks moving toward autonomy are, at present, not explainable. You can't walk someone through the decision-making process to explain precisely why an algorithm produced a specific prediction. Engineers can't peer beneath the hood and easily explain in granular detail what caused something to happen. GPT-4, AlphaGo, and the rest are black boxes, their outputs and decisions based on opaque and impossibly intricate chains of minute signals. The rise of unfathomable alien intelligence undermines democracy. If more and more decisions about people's lives are made in a black box, so voters cannot understand and challenge them, democracy ceases to function. In particular, what happens when crucial decisions, not just about individual lives, but even about collective matters like the Federal Reserve's interest rate, are made by unfathomable algorithms? Human voters may keep choosing a human president, but wouldn't this be just an empty ceremony? Even today, only a small fraction of humanity truly understands the financial system. A 2016 survey by the OECD found that most people had difficulty grasping even simple financial concepts like compound interest. A 2014 survey of British MPs, charged with regulating one of the world's most important financial hubs, found that only 12% accurately understood that new money is created when banks make loans. This fact is among the most basic principles of the modern financial system. As the 2007-08 financial crisis indicated, more complex financial devices and principles, like those behind CDOs, were intelligible to only a few financial wizards. What happens to democracy when AIs create even more complex financial devices and when the number of humans who understand the financial system drops to zero? The increasing unfathomability of our information network is one of the reasons for the recent wave of populist parties and charismatic leaders. When people can no longer make sense of the world, and when they feel overwhelmed by immense amounts of information they cannot digest, they become easy prey for conspiracy theories, and they turn for salvation to something they do understand. A human. Unfortunately, while charismatic leaders certainly have their advantages, no single human, however inspiring or brilliant, can single-handedly decipher how the algorithms that increasingly dominate the world work and make sure that they are fair. The problem is that the algorithms make decisions by relying on numerous data points, whereas humans find it very difficult to consciously reflect on a large number of data points and weigh them against each other. We prefer to work with single data points. That's why, when faced by complex issues, whether a loan request, a pandemic, or a war, we often seek a single reason to take a particular course of action and ignore all other considerations. This is the fallacy of the single cause. We are so bad at weighing together many different factors that when people give a large number of reasons for a particular decision, it usually sounds suspicious. Suppose a good friend failed to attend our wedding. If she provides us with a single explanation, "My mum was in the hospital and I had to visit her," that sounds plausible. But what if she lists 50 different reasons why she decided not to come? "My mom was a bit under the weather and I had to take my dog to the vet sometime this week, and I had this project at work and it was raining, and I know none of these 50 reasons by itself justifies my absence, but when I added all of them together, they kept me from attending your wedding." We don't say things like that, because we don't think along such lines. We don't consciously list 50 different reasons in our mind, give each of them a certain weight, aggregate all the weights, and thereby reach a conclusion. But this is precisely how algorithms assess our criminal potential or our creditworthiness. The Compass algorithm, for example, made its risk assessments by taking into account the answers to a 137-item questionnaire. The same is true of a bank algorithm that refuses to give us a loan. If the EU's GDPR regulations force the bank to explain the algorithm's decision, the explanation will not come in the shape of a single sentence. Rather, it is likely to come in the form of hundreds or even thousands of pages full of numbers and equations. Our algorithm, the imaginary bank letter might read, uses a precise point system to evaluate all applications, taking 1,000 different types of data points into account. It adds all the data points to reach an overall score. People whose overall score is negative are considered low credit persons, too risky to be given a loan. Your overall score was -378, which is why your loan application was refused. The letter might then provide a detailed list of the 1,000 factors the algorithm took into account, including things that most humans might find irrelevant, such as the exact hour the application was submitted, or the type of smartphone the applicant used. Thus, on page 601 of its letter, the bank might explain that you filed your application from your smartphone, which was the latest iPhone model. By analyzing millions of previous loan applications, our algorithm discovered a pattern. People who use the latest iPhone model to file their application are 0.08% more likely to repay the loan. The algorithm therefore added 8 points to your overall score for that. However, at the time your application was sent from your iPhone, its battery was down to 17%. By analyzing millions of previous loan applications, our algorithm discovered another pattern. People who allow their smartphone's battery to go below 25% are 0.5% less likely to repay the loan. You lost 50 points for that. You may well feel that the bank treated you unjustly. Is it reasonable to refuse my loan application, you might complain, just because my phone battery was low? That, however, would be a misunderstanding. The battery wasn't the only reason, the bank would explain. It was only one out of 1,000 factors our algorithm took into account. But didn't your algorithm see that only twice in the last 10 years was my bank account overdrawn? It obviously noticed that, the bank might reply. Look on page 453. You got 300 points for that. But all the other reasons brought your aggregated score down to -378. While we may find this way of making decisions alien, it obviously has potential advantages. When making a decision, it is generally a good idea to take into account all relevant data points rather than just one or two salient facts. There is much room for argument, of course, about who gets to define the relevance of information. Who decides whether something like smartphone models or skin color should be considered relevant to loan applications? But no matter how we define relevance, the ability to take more data into account is likely to be an asset. Indeed, the problem with many human prejudices is that they focus on just one or two data points, like someone's skin color, disability, or gender, while ignoring other information. Banks and other institutions are increasingly relying on algorithms to make decisions, precisely because algorithms can take many more data points into account than humans can. But when it comes to providing explanations, this creates a potentially insurmountable obstacle. How can a human mind analyze and evaluate a decision made on the basis of so many data points? We may well think that the Wisconsin Supreme Court should have forced the North Point Company to reveal how the Compass algorithm decided that Eric Loomis was a high-risk person. But if the full data was disclosed, could either Loomis or the court have made sense of it? It's not just that we need to take numerous data points into account. Perhaps most important, we cannot understand the way the algorithms find patterns in the data and decide on the allocation of points. Even if we know that a banking algorithm detracts a certain number of points from people who allow their smartphone batteries to go below 25%, how can we evaluate whether that's fair? The algorithm wasn't fed this rule by a human engineer. It reached that conclusion by discovering a pattern in millions of previous loan applications. Can an individual human client go over all that data and assess whether that pattern is indeed reliable and unbiased? There is, however, a silver lining to this cloud of numbers. While individual laypersons may be unable to vet complex algorithms, a team of experts getting help from their own AI sidekicks can potentially assess the fairness of algorithmic decisions even more reliably than anyone can assess the fairness of human decisions. After all, while human decisions may seem to rely on just those few data points we are conscious of, in fact our decisions are subconsciously influenced by thousands of additional data points. Being unaware of these subconscious processes, when we deliberate on our decisions or explain them, we often engage in post hoc single point rationalizations for what really happens as billions of neurons interact inside our brain. Accordingly, if a human judge sentences us to 6 years in prison, how can we, or indeed the judge, be sure that the decision was shaped only by fair considerations and not by a subconscious racial bias, or by the fact that the judge was hungry? In the case of flesh and blood judges, the problem cannot be solved, at least not with our current knowledge of biology. In contrast, when an algorithm makes a decision, we can, in principle, know every one of the algorithm's many considerations and the exact weight given to each. Thus, several expert teams, ranging from the US Department of Justice to the non-profit newsroom ProPublica, have picked apart the COMPASS algorithm in order to assess its potential biases. Such teams can harness not only the collective efforts of many humans, but also the power of computers. Just as it is often best to set a thief to catch a thief, so we can use one algorithm to vet another. This raises the question of how we can be sure that the vetting algorithm itself is reliable. Ultimately, there is no purely technological solution to this recursive problem. No matter which technology we develop, we will have to maintain bureaucratic institutions that will audit algorithms and give or refuse them the seal of approval. Such institutions will combine the powers of humans and computers to make sure that new algorithmic systems are safe and fair. Without such institutions, even if we pass laws that provide humans with a right to an explanation, and even if we enact regulations against computer biases, who could enforce these laws and regulations? Nosedive. To vet algorithms, regulatory institutions will need not only to analyze them, but also to translate their discoveries into stories that humans can understand. Otherwise, we will never trust the regulatory institutions and might instead put our faith in conspiracy theories and charismatic leaders. As noted in Chapter 3, it has always been difficult for humans to understand bureaucracy because bureaucracies have deviated from the script of the biological dramas, and most artists have lacked the will or the ability to depict bureaucratic dramas. For example, novels, movies, and TV series about 21st century politics tend to focus on the feuds and love affairs of a few powerful families, as if present-day states were governed in the same way as ancient tribes and kingdoms. This artistic fixation with the biological dramas of dynasties obscures the very real changes that have taken place over the centuries in the dynamics of power. Because computers will increasingly replace human bureaucrats and human mythmakers, this will again change the deep structure of power. To survive, democracies require not just dedicated bureaucratic institutions that can scrutinize these new structures, but also artists who can explain the new structures in accessible and entertaining ways. For example, This has successfully been done by the episode Nosedive in the sci-fi series Black Mirror. Produced in 2016, at a time when few had heard about social credit systems, Nosedive brilliantly explained how such systems work and what threats they pose. The episode tells the story of a woman called Lacey, who lives with her brother Ryan, but wants to move to her own apartment. To get a discount on the new apartment, she needs to increase her social credit score from 4.2 to 4.5 out of 5. Being friends with high-score individuals gets your own score up, so Lacey tries to renew her contact with Naomi, a childhood friend who is currently rated 4.8. Lacey is invited to Naomi's wedding, but on the way there, she spills coffee on a high-score person, which causes her own score to drop a little, which in turn causes the airline to deny her a seat. From there, everything that can go wrong does go wrong. Lacey's rating takes a nosedive, and she ends in jail with a score of less than 1. This story relies on some elements of traditional biological dramas. Boy meets girl, the wedding, sibling rivalry, the tension between Lacey and Ryan, and most important status competition, the main issue of the episode. But the real hero and driving force of the plot isn't Lacey or Naomi, but rather the disembodied algorithm running the social credit system. The algorithm completely changes the dynamics of the old biological dramas, especially the dynamics of status competition. Whereas previously humans were sometimes engaged in status competition, but often had welcome breaks from this highly stressful situation, the omnipresent social credit algorithm eliminates the breaks. Nosedive is not a worn-out story about biological status competition, but rather a prescient exploration of what happens when computer technology changes the rules of status competitions. If bureaucrats and artists learn to cooperate, and if both rely on help from the computers, it might be possible to prevent the computer network from becoming unfathomable. As long as democratic societies understand the computer network, their self-correcting mechanisms are our best guarantee against AI abuses. Thus, the EU's AI Act, proposed in 2021, singled out social credit systems like the one that stars in Nosedive as one of the few types of AI that are totally prohibited, because they might lead to discriminatory outcomes and the exclusion of certain groups, and because they may violate the right to dignity and non-discrimination and the values of equality and justice. As with total surveillance regimes, so also with social credit systems. The fact that they could be created doesn't mean that we must create them. Digital anarchy. The new computer network poses one final threat to democracies. Instead of digital totalitarianism, it could foster digital anarchy. The decentralized nature of democracies and their strong self-correcting mechanisms provide a shield against totalitarianism, but they also make it more difficult to ensure order. To function, a democracy needs to meet two conditions. It needs to enable a free public conversation on key issues, and it needs to maintain a minimum of social order and institutional trust. Free conversation must not slip into anarchy. Especially when dealing with urgent and important problems, the public debate should be conducted according to accepted rules, and there should be a legitimate mechanism to reach some kind of final decision, even if not everybody likes it. Before the advent of newspapers, radios, and other modern information technology, no large-scale society managed to combine free debates with institutional trust, so large-scale democracy was impossible. Now, with the rise of the new computer network, might large-scale democracy again become impossible? One difficulty is that the computer network makes it easier to join the debate. In the past, organizations like newspapers, radio stations, and established political parties acted as gatekeepers, deciding who was heard in the public sphere. Social media undermined the power of these gatekeepers, leading to a more open, but also more anarchical public conversation. Whenever new groups join the conversation, they bring with them new viewpoints and interests, and often question the old consensus about how to conduct the debate and reach decisions. The rules of discussion must be negotiated anew. This is a potentially positive development, one that can lead to a more inclusive democratic system. After all, correcting previous biases and allowing previously disenfranchised people to join the public discussion is a vital part of democracy. However, in the short term, this creates disturbances and disharmony. If no agreement is reached on how to conduct the public debate and how to reach decisions, the result is anarchy rather than democracy. The anarchical potential of AI is particularly alarming, because it is not only new human groups that it allows to join the public debate. For the first time ever, democracy must contend with the cacophony of non-human voices too. On many social media platforms, bots constitute a sizable minority of participants. One analysis estimated that out of a sample of 20 million tweets generated during the 2016 US election campaign, 3.8 million, almost 20%, were generated by bots. By the early 2020s, things got worse. A 2020 study assessed that bots were producing 43.2% of tweets. A more comprehensive 2022 study by the digital intelligence agency SimilarWeb found that 5% of Twitter users were probably bots, but they generated between 20.8% and 29.2% of the content posted to Twitter. When humans try to debate a crucial question like whom to elect as US president, what happens if many of the voices they hear are produced by computers? Another worrying trend concerns content. Bots were initially deployed to influence public opinion by the sheer volume of messages they disseminated. They retweeted or recommended certain human-produced content, but they couldn't create new ideas themselves, nor could they forge intimate bonds with humans. However, the new breed of generative AI tools like ChatGPT can do exactly that. In the 2023 study published in Science Advances, researchers asked humans and ChatGPT to create both accurate and deliberately misleading short texts on issues such as vaccines, 5G technology, climate change, and evolution. The texts were then presented to 700 humans who were asked to evaluate their reliability. The humans were good at recognizing the falsity of human-produced disinformation, but tended to regard AI-produced disinformation as accurate. So, what happens to democratic debates when millions, and eventually billions, of highly intelligent bots are not only composing extremely compelling political manifestos and creating deepfake images and videos, but also able to win our trust and friendship? If I engage online in a political debate with an AI, it is a waste of time for me to try to change the AI's opinions. Being an unconscious entity, it doesn't really care about politics, and it cannot vote in the elections. But the more I talk with the AI, the better it gets to know me, so it can gain my trust, hone its arguments, and gradually change my views. In the battle for hearts and minds, intimacy is an extremely powerful weapon. Previously, political parties could command our attention, but they had difficulty mass-producing intimacy. Radio sets could broadcast a leader's speech to millions, but they could not befriend the listeners. Now a political party, or even a foreign government, could deploy an army of bots that build friendships with millions of citizens, and then use that intimacy to influence their worldview. Finally, algorithms are not only joining the conversation, they are increasingly orchestrating it. Social media allows new groups of humans to challenge the old rules of debate. But negotiations about the new rules are not conducted by humans. Rather, As explained in our previous analysis of social media algorithms, it is often the algorithms that make the rules. In the 19th and 20th centuries, when media moguls censored some views and promoted others,